Really delighted to see you all at this UK Food Group Europe Africa Conference, Securing Future Food. This year, the UK Food Group has been doing the work within an EC-funded project, looking at the relations between Europe and Africa, African regions, and focusing particularly on what we call the model for production, the way in which food is produced, the way in which food is provided. And I think many of you may have seen the briefing, which is available outside, Securing Future Food, which gives a sort of background to the kinds of issues that we've been dealing with our European partners, Terra Nova, Croce Vie, Collectif Stratégie Alimentaire, and also with the African platforms, with Gaia Hungary, most importantly. Thank you, Geza. And with the African farmers platforms of ROPA West Africa, PROPAC Central Africa, and EAFIM East Africa. We'll be able to talk a lot more about these issues during the course of the day. And as we're slightly late in starting, I think I'll stop speaking and introduce the panel and our first speaker, who is Olivier de Schutter. He is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the right to food. He has managed in the relatively few years that he's been doing this to strike the key points in the food discourse at the appropriate moment and currently on the issue of food speculation. And you may have seen some coverage. There is some more in The Guardian today. Olivier, we are absolutely delighted that you've been able to come and see us and speak to us. He'll be followed by Caroline Lucas, and I'll introduce her in a moment. Many of you will know her, Member of Parliament for Brighton Pavilion, and one has to say the first Member of Parliament for the Green Party. I'm delighted to see you as well. So with no more ado, Olivier de Schutter, I'll just put on your presentation. And
thank you very much, and good morning to all. I would like to begin maybe by projecting what I think is the mental map that many policymakers have when speaking about hunger. It's a map that shows how the global number of hungry people has slightly decreased for a while before increasing very sharply in 2008, 2009, and more recently, slightly decreasing again, although these latest statistics showing that 925 million people are hungry in the world do not take into account the recent surge in food prices. That is the map they have. That is the understanding they have of hunger, and I think it's wrong. It's wrong because it gives a very misleading picture of what hunger is about. Hunger is not a phenomenon that can be described with the use of a singular. It affects different groups that face different obstacles, and it calls for a different set of policies in order to meet the needs of each of these groups. And approaching hunger in these aggregate terms, just like looking at the question of food prices, basing yourself on the evolution of prices on the international markets, is a way not to see these solutions. The right to food is important because it obliges us to change its mental map. And when Amartya Sen in 1981 published Poverty and Famines, an essay in entitlements and deprivation, that is exactly what he did. Amartya Sen demonstrated that hunger, famines, were not the result necessarily of a lack of food availability, of low production. Famines could occur in both situations, where there's plenty of food available, but where certain groups of population lose their incomes, or where inequalities increase, making it impossible for those groups to purchase the food they need. Amartya Sen was actually making three messages, three statements about how to approach hunger and malnutrition. First, he emphasized that hunger was a problem of social inequality, that the question of power, social justice, is therefore absolutely key to solving the question of hunger. Secondly, he was showing that the question of accountability was vital. Governments should be monitored, should be controlled by populations in order not to be allowed to remain passive in the face of developing hunger and malnutrition. And thirdly, Amartya Sen, with his entitlements approach, was trying to show that we need to understand hunger, taking as a departure point the situation of the hungry people, and identify who they are in order to identify the obstacles they face. In other terms, instead of the map I was showing a minute ago, he was asking the question of who is hungry. And I believe that we should speak of hunger not in the singular but in the plural to describe not just four, but rather five or six hungers that we are facing. One hunger is affecting some 500 million people today. It's the hunger of smallholder farmers who have been relegated to subsistence farming and who have not been sufficiently supported through public policies since 30, 40 years. Today, some 1.5 to 2 billion people depend on small-scale family agriculture for their livelihoods. And among them, many are unable to produce enough food in order to have incomes that allow them to buy the food they need during the dry season. Many of these small farmers hardly produce more than they need for their own consumption, and whichever surpluses they produce, they sell during the harvest period when the prices are low, and they are obliged to buy back 3-5 months later during the dry season when the prices are higher because they have no storage facilities and because they had no possibility but to sell to the local middlemen, capturing most of the profits along the chain. A second group is that of the landless laborers, those who either have lost their land, sold their land because small-scale farming has become non-viable. Often in rural households, one or two members of the family work also on large-scale plantations, and the others work on the family plots, so that the borderline between these two first groups is not very clear. And these people working on large-scale plantations as wage agricultural laborers are paid very low salaries, they have no social or legal protection, they work in the informal sector, and they cannot complain when they do not receive the wages that they are promised. Often what they do is seasonal work without stable revenues and without revenues that allow them to feed themselves in dignity. A third group is that of small herders, fishers, those who depend on the products of the forests, including many indigenous peoples. And they too form an important proportion of the hungry. They are, like small farmers themselves, they are very severely threatened today by the impact of climate change on their ability to feed themselves. So 80% of those who are hungry are food producers in one way or another, and directly linked to natural resources for their livelihoods. Then we have a group of urban poor, rapidly growing with increased urbanization. Today there are some 1.2 billion people living in the slums in the large cities in developing countries. They live from petty trade. They have no social protection whatsoever. They have often no stable employment, and whichever employment they have is in the informal sector without any legal protection. They too are often hungry, and they are most severely impacted by price spikes since they do not produce any food for themselves. The right to food obliges us to look at these different groups and ask the question of why they are found in this situation, what are the obstacles they face, by examining the chain of causes that leads to these people becoming hungry and malnourished. And by moving along this causality chain, we discover that the question of hunger is not just a technical question, insufficient yields. It becomes a political question, because at some point along the chain, you will identify one public policy, one decision, one measure adopted, which could have been different and which has played a role in creating this situation. That is what the right to food is about. It's about a new way to look at the question of hunger. And it leads us to understand that hunger is not a natural disaster, but the result of policies that can be changed. Hunger, of course, affects different groups, but it can be traced back to a systematic undermining of the ability for small-scale family agriculture in developing countries to prosper. What happened since the 1960s is that farmers have been deprived of their ability to produce in sufficiently good conditions. As a result, poverty progressed in the rural areas. Today, some 75% of the poor live in the rural areas. And the result is that many of them have migrated to the cities, growing the number of the urban poor, and many others have sought to find employment on large-scale plantations, often, as I said, for very low wages. And in a way, all the groups I've described, all the groups I've distinguished, are the victims of this same process of development. The situation we are now facing is more complex than the one I just described, because we are facing two crises, one which I'd like to call the poverty crisis, and one which I'd like to call the ecological crisis. And the challenge I believe that we have to face is to address these two crises together in order to develop sustainable food systems. The poverty crisis essentially is a crisis that stems from a skewed development process that has undermined the viability of small-scale farming in developing countries, and it went through two big phases, which I'd like to briefly recall. First, in the 1960s and 1970s, we had an agricultural development that was very much state-led. We had state cooperatives organizing the farmers. We had marketing boards buying the crops of the farmers in order to feed the cities and in order to finance import substitution policies and industrialization policies. And the result of these policies is that although farmers were taken into consideration in public policies, they were in fact taxed for the benefit of the urban populations. And cheap food was provided to the urban populations. Cheap food was exported on the global markets in order to buy political stability and in order to finance industrialization policies. And so farmers were not forgotten, but they were forced to produce at very low prices in order to feed these policies. In many ways, the system which was state-led was tainted by a neglect of family agriculture, a lack of faith in small-scale farming, and the lack of concern for the needs of the rural communities. This period, 1960-1980, was also characterized by policies that sought to address the question of global hunger by a technological package, which was referred to as the Green Revolution Package, which you're all familiar with. The Green Revolution, which originated in Mexico in 1943, was a technological approach to combating hunger and malnutrition that relied essentially on four components. First, large-scale irrigation. For example, in South Asia, the irrigated areas between 1961 and 2000 grew from 86 million to 176 million hectares. Secondly, the introduction and the spread of new high-yielding varieties of rice, wheat, maize. These are short dwarf varieties which have a more rapid growth and which are in principle able to increase the leaves per hectare, provided they are combined with the right inputs and provided the conditions are in place for this to happen. Thirdly, the use of fertilizers and pesticides. For example, in Asia, between 1961 and 2000, the amount of fertilizers used in agriculture grew from 2 million tons to 70 million tons per year. And fourth and finally, mechanization of agricultural production. Again, in Asia, between 1961 and 2000, the number of tractors grew from 200,000 to 4.8 million tractors used. That is the Green Revolution, and the result of this development was both significant increases in the yields achieved in the regions which developed these policies, with, for example, a tripling of the cereal production in Asia between 1961 and 2000. But at the same time, since many small farmers were unable to benefit from these developments, were excluded from the Green Revolution because they were not suited to this highly capitalized type of agriculture, the spread of inequality and poverty in the countryside. So, in South Asia, for example, while the food availability per capita, taking into account demographic growth, increased 8% between 1970 and 1990, the number of hungry people during the same period of 20 years increased by 9%. And in Latin America, similarly, between 1970 and 1990, food availability per capita increased 8%, but the number of hungry people increased by 17%. The Green Revolution not only had these social impacts, increasing inequalities and the wedge between highly capitalized competitive agriculture on one side and small-scale family farming on the other side, it also had very severe environmental impacts, leading to a loss of crop genetic diversity as a result of the spread of uniform high-yielding varieties, increasing soil erosion and degradation as a result of the spread of monocultures, increasing the pollution of groundwater as a result of the overuse of pesticides and fertilizers. The second period was the 1980s and 1990s, and although the shift was quite significant between the two periods, the victims were still the same. Small farmers, insufficiently supported by public policies in developing countries. 1980s and 1990s were characterized at the level of public policies by the removal of the state from agriculture and the liberalization of agriculture. This was a result of the development, beginning in 1979 with Senegal, of structural adjustment programs that essentially were imposed on developing countries which were highly indebted in order to reassure the international creditors and in order to boost their revenues from exports. Structural adjustment programs led to the local currencies being devalued in order to increase competitiveness of exports. They meant also the lowering or the removal of the subsidies given to farmers because they were considered not to be fiscally sustainable. The downscaling or the removal of extension services providing technical advice to farmers, and of course, the lowering of import tariffs, the opening up of markets to imports, particularly of highly subsidized agricultural products from the OECD countries. Now, the result of this has been an increased dependency of many poor countries on food imports. And this, for example, illustrates the evolutions between 1990 and 2008, showing that for the poorest countries, their food bills was multiplied by 5 or 6 over these 18 years. Now, this is in part the result of demographic growth. It is in part the result of higher prices on international markets, which recently increased over this period. But it also is a result of an undermining of agriculture that is meant to provide for the needs of the local communities and an emphasis on export-led agriculture. The result of this is that when prices go up on international markets, the net food importing countries have very serious balance of payments problems, which can, in many countries, have disastrous social consequences, since the state has no ability to cushion the shock for the poorest households, which often spend 78% of their family budgets on food. And, for example, this is a map showing the impact of the price spike of 2007-2008 on various countries, and the countries which have become net food importing countries, which are in red or in pink on this map, were the most severely impacted countries as a result of these price spikes. The vulnerability of these countries is increased by the fact that, of course, variations in the currency rates make them vulnerable when they depend on food imports to feed their populations. This is what happened recently in Mozambique. Mozambique imports annually some 300,000 tons of wheat because it produces cashew nuts and sugar cane, but it imports much of the wheat it consumes. And when the metical, the local currency, is devalued as against the South African rand, of course, the food bills of Mozambique increase directly as a result. And that is why the Mozambican government felt compelled at some point to raise the price of basic foodstuffs in the country, creating the riots which you all have been following. Well, the main reason for this happening was that Mozambique had prioritized its exports over the needs of its population, was dependent on food imports, and could not face this evolution of the metical as against Iran, the metrics are losing 43% against Iran over the past 12 months. Now,
this emphasis on
trade, food security by increased international trade in the 1980s, very much imposed on developing countries by international financial institutions through these structural adjustment programs, was based on essentially reasoning that agriculture could be treated as a sector like any other, and that producers would adapt to the price signals, that the most efficient producers would emerge victorious, and that overall efficiency gains would be achieved, boosting food production and allowing better food security. That approach to agriculture and that approach to the production of food is based on the presupposition that agriculture responds to the same mechanisms as other sectors. It does not. It has its specificities. Producers cannot adapt to price signals in the same way. And it is also an approach that is completely forgetful of the distributional impacts on various groups of the population of the shock provoked by trade liberalization. Let me take just one example, which is the impact of the entry into force of the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, on the 1st of January 1995, on Mexican farmers producing maize. These farmers were told when the NAFTA was negotiated that, of course, maize or corn produced by US producers would flow into their Mexican local markets, that corn produced in the US with very high subsidies might drive Mexican farmers out. But they were told that they should not fear this, since they could shift to the production of fruits, vegetables, in which they were told they had a comparative advantage. After all, they have a winter growing season in Mexico, and horticulture, fruits and vegetables are very labor intensive, and since wages in Mexico are quite low, they should shift to the production of fruits and vegetables and abandon the production of maize. So what they were told, in fact, is your comparative advantage is in remaining poor, but that is a sad remark. What happened, in fact, is that they discovered they were unable to make the shift. The soils were not adequate for the production of corn. The soils were for the production of fruits and vegetables. They had no access to credit to make the investments in irrigation. They had no access to export chains, except some producers on the northern border of Mexico. And the result was that instead of shifting from producing corn to shifting to the production of fruits and vegetables, they migrated massively to the cities. 2 million farmers, small farmers from Mexico, left their fields and joined the slums of Mexico City between 1995 and 2005. And you might think, well, maybe this is at least a good thing for the urban consumers who need to have access to cheap food because they have, you know, low incomes. But the reality is that this dependency of Mexico on imports of corn for the production of the local tortilla creates a vulnerability that is extremely serious. And for example, in 2006-2007, the price of tortilla increased very significantly as a result of a small number of importers dominating the market and being able to increase the prices for the poor consumers in Mexico. So neither the consumers nor the farmers gained from this shift. I think the main problem with the approach of food production in terms of increased trade liberalization and increased responsiveness to market prices is that it misses the whole point of what food insecurity is about. This view, this policy, is premised on the idea that hunger is a problem of inefficient or insufficient production, when it is primarily a a problem of inequitable distribution, and of groups whose incomes are too low to afford the food that is available on the markets. Trade liberalization, in addition, rewards the most competitive producers, those who can produce at a low price for the markets, and it worsens the situations of the many farmers which are less competitive and who have been the losers in this process. So this is, in a nutshell, the poverty crisis that we have been facing. And then we have the ecological crisis. Here again, I can summarize quite briefly what this crisis has been about. Population, of course, continues to grow. We will be moving to 8.3 billion people on Earth by 2030, presumably some 10 billion people by 2050, and most of this growth will take place in developing countries where already most of the food insecure reside. Every year, the global population increases by some 75 million people, and in many developing countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, the population still doubles every 25 years at every generation. This puts pressure on natural resources, and this pressure will be especially important as climate change will begin to have a very severe impact on our ability to produce food. There are many figures that could describe this, but probably the most impressive is the projection of the yields by 2080 in comparison to the 2000 levels. And this is a projection which has been confirmed by a number of converging studies, which show that by 2080, simply as a result of changes in average temperatures, the yields in many tropical regions will very significantly decrease. And this decrease will not be compensated by the slight increases of production in certain temperate countries in the Northern Hemisphere. In Africa, for example, the yields will decrease by 16-17% in 2080 in comparison to the levels of 2000. The decrease will be 13% in Latin America. It will be significant also in the Middle East and North Africa and in Asia. Overall, it is considered that the global yields will decrease by some 3-5% between 2000 and 2080, simply as a result of changes in temperatures. And the countries where the yields will decrease most are those which are already the most food insecure, those located in the areas which are in red and in orange on this map. If this scenario seems pessimistic, you should remember that this scenario is actually based on a prediction that as a result of increased concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, plants will generally grow faster. This is referred to as the carbon fertilization effect. But scientists are not unanimous about the impact of this carbon fertilization effect, so this is actually the rosiest scenario. And the worst scenario is that global yields will decrease not by 3-5%, but by 12-16%, according to the most recent studies that are available. Now, in addition to this impact of climate change, we are facing, of course, a number of other threats. We are facing the threat of a decline of the growth of agricultural productivity, which has been rising steadily in most regions over the past years, but the growth of agricultural productivity will decline, and in many countries we are already reaching now a plateau. And for example, in the EU, agricultural productivity is not increasing anymore. It is, in fact, rather decreasing by 1.5% annually to date. In the context of a growing population, this is, for many policymakers, a serious concern. And then we are exhausting natural resources. We are facing soil erosion and degradation. For example, 45% of the farmland that is currently cultivated is on very steepy plots of land, and in 9% of the land that is cultivated, those steeps are 30%, which is very significant and accelerates the erosion of soils. Every year, we lose 5 to 10 million hectares of cultivated land as a result of soil erosion. Soil degradation is also accelerating as a result of the overuse of chemical fertilizers, pesticides that destroy the nitrogen and the living organisms in the soil. The freshwater reserves are also being overused, and this is a very serious threat, for example, for countries such as China. So the question is, how are we going to meet these combined challenges, the poverty crisis and the ecological crisis? And I think part of the reason why the situation we are facing is so difficult and complex is that the two must be addressed together. In other terms, the question is, how are we going to meet the demands which are growing for food commodities, while at the same time increasing the incomes of the poor in the rural areas, contributing to rural development, without further accelerating climate change and the destruction of the ecosystems? I believe that the right to food can guide these efforts, and I would like to point at four reasons why it can do so, and four directions in which we could be moving forward. First, I should emphasize that there are different ways to promote agricultural development. There is no single path to modernizing agricultural production. And in fact, it would be extremely dangerous to simply promote a further push towards green revolution techniques, given the dire social consequences these techniques have created, and especially the impacts these technological packages have had on our soils, on our planet, and on the sustainability of the food systems. And indeed, other approaches are possible, although policymakers tend to underestimate their potential and tend to sometimes dismiss them as insufficiently proven. For example, instead of the use of pesticides, we may wish to use push and pull systems in order to ensure that the pests will not destroy the crops. We may prefer to use biological control systems, which use nature against nature, which arrange the crops in order to protect them from the invasion of species. Instead of chemical fertilizers, which, as you know, produce important amounts of nitrous oxide, one of the most damaging greenhouse gases, we can switch to manure, to compost. We can switch to the use of leguminous trees to fertilize the soils. We can switch to locally produced inputs, inputs that come from the farm that itself can regenerate the soils instead of depending on those chemical fertilizers. Instead of using massive irrigation, which often has resulted in the overuse of water supplies and the depletion of the aquifers, we can use water harvesting techniques, arrange the soil in order to ensure that the soil will be moistured by rainfall and that the rainfall will be collected in order to be used for crops cultivation. Instead of monocultures that accelerate the exhaustion of the soils and soil erosion, we can use the combination of different crops on the same plot of land in order to increase complementarity. What I've just been describing is what we refer to usually in the jargon as agroecological approaches,
there is now a very powerful movement showing that agroecological approaches can feed the planet, that in fact they can very significantly increase the yields, the quantity of food produced per hectare, although the potential of agroecological approaches is sometimes limited as a result of incorrect public policies, insufficient support in public policies for these approaches. Where they have been tested, these approaches have been extremely successful in increasing the yields. One of the most impressive studies documenting the potential of these approaches is the one done by Jules Preti and his collaborators in 2006, which compared some 286 sustainable agricultural projects covering 57 countries. And the average yield gains was 79% just by the use of low external input agriculture, the use of locally produced inputs in ways that are far more sustainable than the agro-industrial mode of production that we are sometimes presented as the only path towards modernizing agricultural systems. A second direction we certainly have to move towards is in promoting small-scale family agriculture. This is absolutely key to reducing rural poverty and to allowing small farmers to stay on their land and to live from their farming practices. Here we have to overcome first a widespread prejudice against small-scale farming. I think to a large extent, this prejudice, which is very much a cultural prejudice, is the result of a self-fulfilling prophecy. In some, there was a lack of faith in the ability of small-scale farming to be productive. Therefore, no investments were made in that kind of small-scale family farming. Therefore, it could not demonstrate its potential and demonstrate its productivity. And therefore, the prejudice against small-scale farming had been reinforced in the minds of many policymakers. Secondly, I think small-scale farming suffers from the fact that although it is highly productive per hectare, although the use made of the resources available is highly efficient on small plots of land, which are combining different crops and small ruminants on the same area of land, this type of farming is often less competitive on the markets. And the reason is simply that it is often more labor-intensive, that therefore it is less capable than the large-scale, highly mechanized plantations to produce food at low cost, the way large-scale plantations produce food. And so, if we leave this to the market mechanisms, the risk is that small-scale family farming will be driven out of business as a result of this competition linked to the spread of large-scale plantations. Now, when I say that large-scale plantations can be more competitive, better at producing at a low cost, I refer to the price at which they are able to sell the food. But we should consider that large-scale plantations using high amounts of chemical fertilizers, highly mechanized, dependent on fossil fuels for the production and for the transportation of inputs and food, they are less sustainable and they produce high social costs and environmental costs, which the price of food does not take into account. A contrario, small-scale family farming has a number of positive externalities. It produces employment, it contributes to rural development, it preserves better the ecosystems, or at least it could preserve better the ecosystems if well managed, and these positive externalities are not rewarded by the current food system. The right to food approach is one that asks us to prioritize the type of farming that is most conducive of poverty reduction and that best supports the small farmers, which are today the most important victims of global hunger. Third, the direction
the third direction we have to explore is that of local food systems. Now, I don't have time to detail this, but I'm encouraged to see that in many countries, including the UK, a number of local food systems are developing, of which the larger public is increasingly aware. Urban agriculture, community-supported agriculture, farmers' markets, for example, are spreading at a very impressive speed. There are a number of reasons why these local food systems deserve to be better supported. There are a number of reasons why they can be considered to be more sustainable. They increase the revenues of producers without increasing the cost of food for consumers, and they are much more sustainable from the point of view of environmental sustainability, but I don't have time to detail the advantages of these local food systems. Fourth and finally, let me close by saying that one very important tool that the right to food provides us with is the insistence on developing long-term strategies, which in the jargon of the right to food are called strategies for the progressive realization of the right to food, to move towards more sustainable food systems, systems that do not simply increase production, but also combat rural poverty and preserve the ecosystems. These national strategies are important. They consist in governments organizing in a participatory process a multi-annual action plan to move towards systems of producing and distributing food that are more sustainable. This increases accountability of governments, it increases the consistency across the years of the strategies that they pursue, and it allows a better monitoring of the measures adopted by governments, by civil society organizations and farmers' organizations involved in co-designing these strategies with governmental agencies. These national strategies are premised on a very simple idea that is very much at the basis of our modern democracies, which is that even the largest collective problems can be met if we break down these challenges in smaller pieces, and if we take each of these problems one by one and address them by appropriate measures. I believe that this is the idea that we now have to retain. Thank you very much.
Olivier, thank you so much on behalf of all of us for that wonderful discourse, and indeed it could have been significantly longer. I apologize that the day is not infinitely extendable. There are many, many issues which I think we'll have an opportunity to come back to discuss amongst ourselves, and indeed in the final panel, which I'll talk about more soon, be able to question Olivier about some of the issues. Olivia, I understand you're being called away by the BBC in a moment for a live interview on television, so he will disappear. It's not because he doesn't like us, and you are coming back. So thank you very much indeed, and once again, thank you so much for sweetness into your schedule.